All right, so that always nice to take some time for a little meditation. And let's see. So, like I said, my topic is around non-clinging. Joseph Goldstein, who I would say is definitely one of my main teachers these days in particular, he said that people sometimes ask him, because they know he's done various Buddhist practices over the years, whether it's metta practice or concentration practice or, various things. So people ask him, well, what's your practice these days, Joseph? And he said, no, he just answers, my practice is non-clinging. And that's his practice. So I guess that's one inspiration for the talk tonight. I just love that answer because that's something we can practice anywhere, anytime, right? It doesn't necessarily require being on the cushion. And it's kind of something that doesn't seem to come that naturally to me. So I have to practice it. I think I'm much better at clinging. So that's why it seems to be a powerful mantra for me at this point, just to, like, non-clinging, what would that look like? And yeah, it's been a long journey for me. I didn't necessarily expect to be on this sort of spiritual path that I've been on for the last 36 years now, but when I was 21, I found out I was an alcoholic, basically, and had an addiction to marijuana as well, which just kind of put me on this spiritual journey that I hadn't really planned, as life will do to us. And at first, I just went through the usual routes of, learning about how to work with those issues in my life. And but then in 1993, somebody said, there's this guy, Jack Kornfield, who gives a talk every Monday night at a place called Spirit Rock, and I think you should come with me and hear him talk. And I just thought, Jack Kornfield? I've never heard of his name. Spirit Rock, that sounds a little out there. I wasn't sure. But I trusted this person, so I went with her, and of course, I guess you could say it definitely changed my life because it just really spoke to me. And I'd never heard of insight meditation at the time. I'd read books on Zen Buddhism and thought they sounded really great, but I definitely didn't get it. And so anyway, there are various stories from that time that Jack would tell. And I don't know why exactly, but one of them came up for me while preparing this talk, and I thought I would share it with you. And there's a decent chance you've heard it before, but we'll see. And it's about a Buddha statue in Thailand. And so he wrote, this is Jack, wrote, in a large temple north of Thailand's ancient capital, Sukhothai, I'm not totally sure of the pronunciation. There once stood an enormous and ancient clay Buddha. Though not the most handsome or refined work of Thai Buddhist art, it had been cared for over a period of 500 years and had become revered for its sheer longevity. Violent storms, changes of government, and invading armies had come and gone, but the Buddha endured. At one point, however, the monks who tended the temple noticed that the statue had begun to crack and would soon be in need of repair and repainting. After a stretch of particularly hot, dry weather, one of the cracks became so wide that a curious monk took his flashlight and peered inside. What shone back at him was a flash of brilliant gold. Inside this plain old statue, the temple residents discovered one of the largest and most luminous gold images of Buddha ever created in Southeast Asia. Some pure gold Buddha statue, now uncovered, the golden Buddha draws throngs of devoted pilgrims from all over Thailand. And I think that was 1955 when it was the plaster was chipped off accidentally and somebody saw gold gleaming inside and they realized that the stucco and colored glass on the outside was actually hiding a gold statue that had been, because the armies of Burma had invaded, for one thing. But anyway, then Jack goes on. The monks believe that this shining work of art had been covered in plaster and clay to protect it during times of conflict and unrest. In much the same way, each of us has encountered threatening situations that lead us to cover our innate nobility. Just as the people of ancient Thailand had forgotten about the Golden Buddha, we too have forgotten our essential nature. Much of the time we operate from the protective layer. The primary aim of Buddhist psychology is to help us see beneath this armoring and bring out our original goodness, sometimes called our Buddha nature. I don't know, that story always kind of just, I don't know, it just appealed to me because I, grew up with things like Indiana Jones or whatever, the quest for the Golden City or something, so then I even had the chance when I went to Bangkok a few years ago, it was really cool that I was able to go and actually see this statue. And it felt really, I don't know why, it felt really affirming that it was a real statue. It wasn't just a tall tale, but that you actually can go to Chinatown in Bangkok and go to this little temple and you go up some steps and go inside and there's this magnificent 10-foot golden Buddha statue that's, they say it's weighs 5.5 tons and is worth $250 million or something. But the real point is that we have this, we don't need to seek gold outside of ourselves. That this journey is about uncovering the gold hidden within, and I know for me, my inner gold had been covered over with the addiction stuff that I was talking about. And it really was, there really was a sense of kind of being plastered over, like my heart felt sort of plastered over in a way. And it was quite a journey, it's been a process to kind of pull the plaster off. It didn't come off all at once. And there's still some bits of it, I'm sure. But I don't know, that story just kind of occurred to me. I mean, I even bought I even bought the replica at the temple of that statue. So this is the reminder, by the way. If you want to know what it looked like, it was this if it was 10 feet tall and made of pure gold. All right, so I have a whole collection of Buddha statues on the wall behind my computer. It's kind of not fair because I can't show it to anybody. But again, these are just great reminders of the inner Buddha within each of us that we can cultivate, And the non-clinging, what I'm learning is that a lot of the way that we, reveal our own inner nobility, as Jack puts it, is through non-clinging. And it's non-clinging to what? Non-clinging to greed, to aversion, to delusion, to the defilements, as they're called. And when we kind of let go of those things that block us, then our sort of, the awakening factors can be revealed and our own innate ability to be an awake, kind, caring human being can emerge. And meditation has really been what's helped me start to really have a true experience of this. And of course, there's a lot to learn along the way. But I love how Ajahn Chah, the Thai Forest Master, who was also Jack Kornfield's teacher, I kind of feel like he was my teacher by through Jack Kornfield, because it was really the stories of Ajahn Chah that tended to speak to me the most when I would hear Jack talk a lot. But Ajahn Chah said, "The heart of the path is so simple. No need for long explanations. Give up clinging to love and hate. Just rest with things as they are. That is all I do in my own practice. Do not try to become anything. Do not make yourself into anything. Do not be a meditator." I love that. "Do not become enlightened. When you sit, let it be. When you walk, let it be. Grasp at nothing. Resist nothing." And then he goes on, just one last bit. "Of course, there are dozens of meditation techniques to develop samadhi, concentration, and many kinds of vipassana. But it all comes back to this. Just let it all be. Step over here, where it is cool, out of the battle." Out of the battle. There was another teacher, like a non-dual type of teacher, that would always say, "Call off the search. Call off the search," which I really love, because I realized I'd been on some kind of search my whole life, and it was quite novel to think of calling off the search. And what would we be left with if we just called off the search? Yeah, there's a lot to say about this topic. And trying to think of another aspect of this, or one of the ways that we really start to learn how to let go and not, you know, practice non-clinging is through, you've probably heard this before, through the lens of impermanence, seeing how everything's constantly changing. And that, so there's not really anything to hold on to in the first place. We think that there is, right? But we start to see when we really examine this nature of the world we're in, that there really isn't anything to cling to. Even one of my teachers sums up the teachings. So you probably heard of Venerable Anālio, or Bhikkhu Anālio, a German monk. Well, he says, his phrase that he came up with for practice is, "Keep calmly knowing change and never cling to anything. Keep calmly knowing change and never cling to anything." That's his summing up of the four foundations of mindfulness, Satipatthana. I want to get like a t-shirt that just says, "Keep calmly knowing change." That probably seems like a good one. But yeah, I just find that great. And then there's a song, like a chant that I heard a long time ago, and that we chant in the prison a lot, because one of my fellow volunteers in the prison has a beautiful voice, and she will chant this, and then I will chant with her, but softly, so that we mostly hear her. But the song goes, "All things are impermanent, they arise and they pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings great happiness." And you just keep chanting that over and over. Sorry that I'm not known for my chanting voice, but "All things are impermanent, they arise and they pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings great happiness." And it's very somewhat counterintuitive that this would bring great happiness, right? But it's not exactly the same kind of happiness that I think I was looking for earlier in life, you know, where everything had to be exciting and new and I don't know what all the time, kind of adrenaline driven or something. But it's definitely a different type of great happiness, which kind of the Ajahn Chah, I think, was describing pretty well about when he said to step over where it's cool. It's a more of a cool happiness, that's where we're kind of unruffled. There's a peace, an ease with the way things are, and a way, you know, a non-reactivity to life on life's terms. Step over here where it is cool out of the battle, Legend Cha said. And so I didn't necessarily, that's not what I thought I was looking for at one point, But certainly over time, I've come to really appreciate that more and more. And so really, comes down to seeing impermanence, how they're, and this can really be helpful in daily life in ways I've found it applicable in unexpected ways. So one story I like to tell is that I was taking this course of, it was a Buddhist course with Gil Fronsdale, who lives, he teaches, my daughter is knocking, but she's gonna go away. So anyway, I was taking this course and I had to drive. It was a Friday morning class with Gil Fronsdale, and I had to drive through rush hour traffic to get there. And it seemed to be hard to get there on time. So and I was feeling bad about being there a little late the previous time. So I was really determined to be there early this time. So I left early, was doing great. I have to go over a bridge that has a toll booth. And as I was approaching the toll booth, in I think it was, I don't know if it's 8 lanes of traffic or more, just so many lanes of traffic, and it's all bumper to bumper cars. And all of a sudden, I realize my car is going bump 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 bump, bump, and I have a flat tire. like the worst place to have a flat tire. There's just cars everywhere, and I'm right in the middle of it all. I'm really, all I want to do is get to this class on time. And so somehow I managed to get my car over to the shoulder of the road, and it was a used car, but it was new to me, and it was a German car, and I had never even thought about like looking at the flat tire, the spare tire or anything, but I had changed lots of tires from other cars, right? So I'm thinking, if I have to call somebody in this traffic, it's going to take hours for the tow truck to get here to help me. So I'm going to do this myself. So I go and open the trunk, and when I pull out the equipment, it's not, I guess I'm used to Japanese style equipment, like to the jack and ring. And the German version is just looks like nothing I've ever seen before. And so I'm like, oh my God. And I really want to do this fast. Anyway, somehow I got it all put together, finally get the car cranked up. And then the tire lug nuts are so like factory sealed, and no matter what I do, it feels like I cannot budge them. So at this point, I'm starting to kind of just lose it, like not get, I don't know, it was just kind of like nothing was going well. And I guess I felt some sense of despair in that moment. Just all alone, all these cars going by, nobody's helping me. And at this point, anyway, but then I had this one thought, and this is the point of my story here. And the thought was, well, by this time tomorrow, I will have resolved this and I won't still be out here on the road. And somehow that, just that thought, like by this time tomorrow, this won't be a problem. Like I will figure it out. It really just opened some space that was extremely helpful. I don't know how to put it, but and so then it just gave me a little extra energy or something, and then I finally got the first lug nut to crack or whatever, and I eventually got the tire changed and was of course late to my class, but not too late. Wasn't too bad. But I was amazed that just that one thought made such a difference in this very sort of trying moment. Just kind of opened up a space that wouldn't have been there if I didn't have this practice, I don't think. And I mean, that's just one little example, but it really has stayed with me. And course, there's other lessons we could probably learn from that, like being clinging to needing to be at the class on time or whatever. But nonetheless, that thought about impermanence can be very practical and helpful. I, on a more serious note, when my father who passed away over about 13 years ago or something. He was diagnosed with, a terminal illness, and the impermanence just came right. I actually learned the news that he had this diagnosis while I was at a Buddhist monastery. So that sort of helped in a way. It kind of brought the teachings right into my kind of right there. And I did think of impermanence. And the thought came to me, well, he was always going to die. It's just that now is the time. And that actually was very helpful in not clinging to like things should be different and this shouldn't be happening. It's like, well, this is what's happening. And it really helped me be present with him when I was there with him for the last about 14 months of his life. He was originally diagnosed that you have 3 months to live, and he made it 14 months, so still pretty good. But it was amazingly helpful to have heard these teachings. So let's see. I'm just aware of time. It goes pretty quickly here. The Joseph Goldstein in his book Mindfulness says we can be mindful of impermanence on many levels, nature, climate change, evolution, the collective level, rise and fall of civilizations and cultures, the personal, people are born and die. And given all these examples of change that are before us all the time, it's striking that we often still find the changes in our lives surprising. Somehow we count on things staying a certain way, or at least if they're going to change, they will change to our liking. That's another funny thing that we do. I've done this so many times. It's okay if it changes as long as it changes the way I want it to change. So we have our preferences as well. So the practice just helps us see how that's not realistic. That we don't get to decide how everything's going to change. Certainly, we wouldn't have chosen COVID-19 or to come along and do all the things it did. And then another important practice in Buddhism is facing our mortality, contemplation of death for ourselves, that we're impermanent as well. And we also have this weird sense that even when somebody we know dies, there's this weird sense that's like, wow, that's rough for them. But as if it's not going to happen to us too. There's some weird disconnect that can happen there. And so it's very powerful to take in the fact that we are also going to die, that this is part of the world. Everything that's born will also pass away. So this can be a very powerful contemplation for us. Joseph, I was listening to a talk by Joseph Goldstein recently, and he was saying, imagine yourself on your deathbed and imagine what is the mind attached to? So that in terms of non-clinging, if we can imagine ourselves on our deathbed, then we might also imagine what is it that we would still be clinging to, that we wouldn't want to have to let go of. And can we start to practice letting go of even that now? Can we train ourselves now so that when that time does come, it's not such a shock, or it's not so difficult that we've kind of. And they say the Dalai Lama gets up every morning and practices some version of this. And so it is. And I mentioned Venerable Anālio, who I also consider one of my main teachers. I don't know if you've heard this before, but he sleeps in a coffin. He takes this practice so seriously that his bed is shaped like a coffin intentionally. I don't think he bought a real coffin. I think somebody built a coffin-shaped bed around him. But just as a reminder, And he also keeps a skeleton around, a life-size skeleton in his room to keep as a reminder that kind of that's where we're all going to end up, is, you know, a bunch of bones. And, you know, I have to admit, I thought that sleeping in a coffin seemed pretty extreme when I first heard it, but I've come to really appreciate that he takes it to that level. And then I found out he gave an interview. I had actually heard this before, but he gave an interview to Barry Center for Buddhist Studies recently. It was in their newsletter, if anybody gets that. So you can read this. But he had his grandfather was one of the most beloved figures in his life when he was a boy in Germany. And when he was 14 years old, I believe, his grandfather died right in front of him. I think he was there with his grandfather. I'm not sure what the circumstances were. And so that really impacted, I think, his life. And he says in the interview, "My grandfather's death really made me realize that I needed to face mortality, both my own and that of others. This has been a theme that has continued throughout my life. Every day I practice recollection of death. Moreover, if I want to do something, I will do it right away and wholeheartedly, because who knows when I or others will die. So my grandfather had, in a way, given me the most important gift he could ever have given me. He left behind this central message for me: face mortality." And yeah, it's tough. I mean, my daughter, who I mentioned, is only 6, and she's had 2 best friends so far in life. You know, like these were little other little girls that they just, as soon as they met and I was there, they had this immediate connection that was very hard to explain, but they just got each other right away and they wanted to spend a lot of time together. And I forget why the first one, we went to a different school from the first one, and we just kind of fell out, and then COVID hit. So the first friend kind of fell away as a result of school change and COVID. And now she's had this other best friend who they are just so close. And when they see each other, they hug and they walk around holding hands. It's very sweet. They laugh together. Well, now that best friend has just moved away somewhat unexpectedly due to like a situation with their family. So, I really feel for her. And this is just the way things are. You know, it's not a reliable situation we're in. So she's getting these kind of lessons early, but it's tough, you know. I'm not trying to, I'm just, we're, you know, just seeing that we're all dealing with this. But, and there's much more to be said about this topic, but I guess I'm running out of time. The other thing I'll just say is that the other thing we cling to is pleasant experiences, right? We really like pleasant experiences, and we really don't like unpleasant ones or painful ones. And that's another thing the practice really has helped me with, is just learning to be okay with unpleasant experiences that I can't avoid, and also to not be so focused on pleasant experience all the time. Or the one caveat is we are kind of, according to the Buddha, allowed to reach towards pleasant meditative experiences, what Venerable Anālya has termed unworldly pleasant feeling tones, the kind that we might have while meditating, where you get, or I mentioned the joy, the subtle joy of being in the present moment could be, so that we learn to find pleasant experiences in a more wholesome way than, at least, than I used to focus on. And this is just the path towards greater, you know, peace and happiness, as Ajahn Chah mentioned. Step over here where it is cool, out of the battle. So that's if you want to step out of the battle. Well, thank you for listening. I guess we need to end there. But those are a few reflections on non-clinging and facing impermanence. There's much more to be said, and I'm sure that you've heard all of this before, but you know, these are reminders.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.